ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, so obviously everyone is well aware of what's going on in the markets right now with the coronavirus fears and the potential economic fallout from that. The markets did have a nice bounce back yesterday, but you know, today we're already bouncing around here at the open. Of course, last week, stocks had their worst week since the global financial crisis in 2008. It was also the fastest stock market correction ever. The S&P 500 was down nearly 13% from its record high, which that was just hit on February 19th. I guess life comes at you fast. So as it stands now, the S&P 500 is down about 5% on the year. On the bond side, the 10-year Treasury hit a record low. It's now at around 1.1%, which that's pretty hard to believe as well. Gold is up 5% on the year. In just a moment, I'll be joined by ETF.com Sumeet Roy. We're going to dive into a little bit of everything. I certainly want to get Sumeet's take on the coronavirus and what we're seeing in the financial markets right now. And then we'll also look at how ETFs are faring. We'll talk ETF flows, ETF performance, trading. It should be interesting. Sumeet covers all of this extremely closely. So again, he'll join me here momentarily. Also on the show this week is Connor Platt, founder of Confluence Analytics. They're an ESG research firm. And Connor has a unique perspective on ESG data in particular, in terms of how it's compiled and used by investors. You know, at the end of the day, the underlying data is what's powering a lot of these ESG ETFs. And I haven't really dug into this much on the podcast, so I'm looking forward to this. Connor knows the space inside and out. Should be a good conversation as well. And then also later, always one of my favorite guests, Wes Gray, CEO of Alpha Architect. He'll join me to talk about their ETF white labeling business, which this is something Alpha Architect just got involved in last year. Wes is going to explain what all that entails. And I think if you're an investor, you might find it interesting just to hear how new ETFs come to market, how the sausage is made behind the scenes. Wes and I will also touch on ESG investing, which I've never discussed this with Wes before, so I'm very curious to get his take. And then we'll briefly talk ETF portfolio construction as well. Great show. Questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can go to ETFprime.com. Let's talk markets and ETFs with ETF.com, Sumeet Roy.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
Just like with the stock, it's a function of the volume of the security. You can often put your limit order in between those two prices. The SEC is still concerned about how do you value cryptocurrencies.
Sumeet, great having you back on the podcast. It's been a little while.
Thanks so much for having me, Nate. It's great to be here.
Okay, so let's start with everything going on in the markets first, and then we can pivot over to the ETF side of the story, which is really interesting. As I mentioned, the S&P 500 is now down about 5% on the year. It was down over 8% just last week. And look, obviously, neither you or I have a crystal ball, but I would be curious just to get your take on this overall coronavirus situation right now. I mean, are you viewing this as a short-term blip? Do you think the market implications are much more serious and longer term? How are you reading this right now?
Well, I think you said it right, Nate. None of us has a crystal ball. Absolutely no one in the market has a crystal ball. So any forecast about what could potentially happen with the coronavirus and the impact on economic growth and things like that is just speculation. But, you know, that being said, you know, people are going to speculate. It's only natural when you get, you know, this type of news flowing through into the market. And people are going to not only speculate, they're going to extrapolate. You know, we've seen what happened in China. We saw the quarantine of millions of people in China. We saw the ghost towns. We saw the factories and all the storefronts that shut down in that country. And then we saw what happened to the economy after all that happened. On Saturday, we finally got some numbers to all that, and we saw China's manufacturing PMI. It dropped to an all-time low, I think around 35 or something like that. And that's even lower than where the PMI was during the financial crisis. So people are extrapolating, what if that happened here in the U.S.? And it's interesting, you know, if this was all contained in China, like the market initially thought it was going to be up until a week and a half ago or so, the reaction wouldn't be as bad as it has been. I mean, it's when the virus started spreading outside of China into South Korea, Italy, Iran, and now it's in the U.S. That's when investors started to get spooked, because then now you're talking about a global pandemic, something that can't be contained, that causes widespread fear, supply chain disruptions, collapsing consumer demand, things like that. So that's really got investors spooked. This could be a global thing. And suddenly they're thinking worst-case scenarios. They're thinking, the early 20th century Spanish flu, which infected 500 million people and killed something like 50 million people. They're thinking those worst-case scenarios. But I don't think investors should panic. I think they should stay calm because none of us has a crystal ball.
Well, you know what's interesting about this? You mentioned widespread fear, and obviously I'm no health expert or medical profession. I know you're not either. I see people out there wanting to sort of make comparisons to the common flu, right? And say, well, look at how many people die from the common flu every year. The coronavirus isn't a big deal. And my response to that is put the medical side of the equation, you know, put that to the side right now. If people are fearful and they're scared, that has an economic impact, period. It doesn't matter how serious the coronavirus ultimately ends up being. If people are scared and they think it's serious and they stop, going to work or factory shut down, they stop buying stuff, they stop going to restaurants, that causes an economic disruption. And I think that sort of gets lost in the discussion here when people want to, you know, either say this is really serious or not really serious in terms of the coronavirus. Again, I don't think it matters. It's how people perceive it. I think another interesting aspect here is just the political ramifications. Obviously, Trump's running on, his platform's on a strong economy. And if things start deteriorating a little bit, that becomes problematic. And I think if somebody like, Bernie Sanders, we'll see what happens today, Super Tuesday, and where Joe Biden ends up. But Bernie Sanders running on, healthcare for all. What if you have a bunch of people who get sick, they're uninsured, and they rack up large hospital bills? Well, some people might start running into Bernie Sanders' arms in terms of the general election. So I think that's interesting as well. I guess the other aspect to watch here is what will the Fed do, right? And I know investors, over the past 10 years, there's been a lot of talk about how much the Fed has helped the markets, has been a significant tailwind. That's the other wild card. I guess on that note, I mean, do you have any thoughts on sort of how the Fed may approach this?
You're absolutely right. And it's really the fear of the unknown and the Fed kind of being useless in this type of situation. I mean, they could cut rates, but it's really not going to and change the virus or really reduce the impact of the virus. It could help loosen up financial conditions a little bit, but the Fed having little to no power over this virus, I think, is causing some of the fear in the markets. And like you said also, if people are just fearful, hunkering down in their houses, regardless of how deadly or not deadly the virus is, that's going to have some impact. And that's really what happened in China. We've seen 2,000 some odd deaths in China, but compared to the billion plus population over there, relatively small, yet we still saw the largest contraction in manufacturing pretty much ever in that country. So that's the fear, and those are the type of worst case scenarios people are fearful about. But I would just say the worst case scenario is not inevitable. I mean, we've seen deadly viruses come and go every decade. We saw SARS, we saw MERS, we saw Ebola, we saw the swine flu. So we've seen those, and the global economy has survived. So, you know, it remains to be seen what impact this has. But I think there is reason to be optimistic. The mortality rate, something like 1%, is what we're seeing in countries with advanced healthcare systems. And experts say that number could even trend down as healthcare professionals learn more about the virus and how to deal with it. And, you know, treatments and potentially even vaccines are developed down the line. So in that regard, given that, you know, the worst case scenario is not inevitable and things could potentially get better and the market's down, you know, 16% peak to trough, I don't think now is the time for investors to panic and make rash decisions because no one knows ahead of anyone else what's going to happen. So I think if you're a long-term investor, just stick to your long-term plan, don't react to the day-to-day headlines, and if you're a trader, well, then just enjoy the volatility.
No, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's always wise counsel. Sumeet, let's pivot over to the ETF side of the story, which I find fascinating just watching everything last week. And let's maybe start with ETF flows last week. I did see $21 billion flowed out of ETFs overall. What stood out here just in terms of specific ETF inflows and outflows?
So, yeah, Nate, we did see an outflow from U.S.-listed ETFs last week. And that was actually the first weekly outflow of the year. But it was relatively modest. If you think about how bad the performance in stocks was last week, we only saw $21 billion of outflows. And year to date, we still have net inflows of around $75 billion. And that's something like 3-4 times what we had last year.
Yeah, that's still a big number.
Yeah, absolutely. And that tells me that, you know, ETF investors, they're not panicking. And they're even buying some ETFs, things like Vanguard ETFs, VTI, VOO, and even IVV, the iShares product. We've seen the kind of long-term buy and hold type products. Those are the ETFs that people are gravitating to, in addition to, of course, the investment-grade bond ETFs, the treasury ETFs, things like that. IEF was actually the biggest flows winner last week. That's only natural when you're seeing the 10-year drop to all-time lows. And then you even saw speculators coming in to the ETF market. They're buying things like the Pro Shares Ultra Pro QQQ, ticker symbol TQQQ, which is pretty much leveraged exposure to the triple Qs. And that paid off big on Monday. We saw 15% surge in that ETF as the market rallied something like 5%. And then on the outflow side, we saw SPY lose about $19 billion. That's not really that surprising. SPY tends to be a favorite among traders who get in and out. I think more interestingly, we saw outflows from the junk bond ETFs, like HYG at $4 billion in outflows, and JNK at $1.2 billion in outflows. So we saw a lot of trepidation about junk bonds last week. As, you know, investors, they were concerned that if we do get a hit to the economy from the coronavirus, the companies with the weakest balance sheets, the ones that raise money through junk bonds, they're going to get hit the hardest.
By the way, you mentioned Vanguard. I don't know if you saw this last week. Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas pointed out that Vanguard broke their monthly flow record in February, $25 billion, with about $6.5 billion of that coming last week. And you pointed it out, you know, ETFs like VTI, the Vanguard Total Stock Market ETF, VOO, the S&P 500 ETF. Do you think this is just another indication that Vanguard investors are a bit of a different breed?
No, absolutely. I mean, they are a different breed. They're buy and hold long-term investors. They don't care what's going on day to day. And this is just another data point that corroborates that. It doesn't change the fact Vanguard is the buy and hold issuer.
Okay, what about from an ETF performance perspective? I guess both good and bad. And I'm guessing this aligns somewhat closely with inflows and outflows, but what ETF stood out here?
In terms of performance, I mean, we mentioned the treasuries, TLT, the 20-plus year treasury ETF. That thing was on fire last week. I think it's up something like 40% year to date, and half of those gains came in the last 2 weeks. And the 30-year, I think, is up to 1.58%, so that's giving support to TLT. And then GLD, the gold ETF, that was going up for much of last week when we saw gold prices top 1650. That was a 7-year high. But then, interestingly, later in the week, gold prices actually dropped as investors presumably used that that commodity as a source of capital when everything else is going down. Gold was up, so they decided to sell, maybe to raise capital and buy something that's cheaper. And then on the downside, one interesting ETF I've been keeping an eye on is the U.S. Global Jets ETF, JETS. That's been in focus because airlines are obviously canceling tons of flights, and they're losing a lot of business, so they're getting hit hard. And we saw mid-February JETS was actually flat on a year-to-date basis, and now it's down 25% year-to-date, so huge hit for that ETF. But it could be interesting if you're looking for a rebound play once all of this kind of works through the system. So JETS is one to keep an eye on. And then finally, I'd look at XLE, the Energy Select Sector SBDR fund. That one got absolutely hammered with oil prices going under 50. And now it's at an 11-year low, and it's yielding something like 5%. So if you're a value investor or an income investor, I think you should take a look at XLE. That could be a little interesting.
Yeah, I was running some performance figures over the weekend, and it was amazing. I mean, energy this year is just getting absolutely bludgeoned. You know, you look at something like USO, the United States Oil Fund, that was down nearly 11% last week. Obviously, concerns over an economic slowdown, and, you know, I think there's been a lack of appetite to cut production from OPEC and Russia. Something else that caught my attention, somewhat surprisingly, the China ETFs aren't down as much as you might expect. You know, you look at something like the iShares MSCI China ETF, that was basically flat last week. Does that surprise you?
It does surprise me, and I think there could be two reasons for that. One could be simply that China got hit with the virus first, and they took these drastic actions. So people are speculating that China might be the first one to kind of get out of this negative situation and move forward from here, because they were the first ones to get hit, and they took such big actions to combat the virus. The second thing I think about is, you know, the Chinese government, they often intervene in the financial markets, so potentially they could be supporting their equity markets here and keep trying to keep prices from falling even further. So it's kind of difficult to tell which of those two factors is the biggest factor. But, I mean, it's super surprising that China, which is the epicenter of the virus, is actually holding up better than a lot of markets around the world.
Sumit, I think one of the benefits of a market environment like we're seeing right now is it provides an opportunity for some ETFs to really shine, right? Because with the market we've had over the past 10 years or so, there really haven't been that many opportunities. And one ETF that stood out to me last week was SWAN, the Amplify Black Swan Growth and Treasury Core ETF. It outperformed the S&P by like 9 or 10%. I'm just curious, any other ETFs like that maybe hedge or do something drastically different that caught your attention?
I'd say VXX, which is the volatility product that tracks the VIX index, that was pretty interesting last week. I think it went up something like 53%, as you would expect, given that the VIX spiked over 50. But as I wrote on ETF.com, unless you timed your purchase perfectly, VXX probably didn't even give you that effective of a hedge, because on a year-over-year basis, it's still down 28%, even though it was up 53% last week. That's because it has to roll over those futures contracts every month, and those roll costs really negatively impact the return on that fund over time. So unless you were in investment-grade bonds or gold last week, it doesn't seem to me that much of anything was immune to last week's sell-off. I mean, even trend pilot ETFs like the PTLC or buffer ETFs from Innovator, even they got hit last week because their protective powers really don't kick in until you get a bigger sell-off, something like 20, 30, 40%. That's when they, you know, hedge you or switch out of equities into treasuries. So, you know, it's really hard to avoid a sell-off in this 10% to 20% range. There's not a lot of ETFs that are going to protect you from that and yet still, you know, give you upside if the market rallies to new highs. So really, treasuries and gold are the only thing that are going to be immune, or unless you have inverse ETFs, those are, of course, going to rally.
Sumit, only a couple minutes left. One other area I wanted to touch on, you know, another benefit that I think came out of the markets last week, and you know I'm always looking for silver linings, trying to stay optimistic, but I think we have to talk a little bit about ETF trading. because there's always this talk that ETF liquidity will dry up in a market downturn and ETFs won't function properly, right? Death spirals. We saw none of that. And in fact, there's been record trading volume in ETFs like SPY and HYG that you pointed out earlier. Everything is functioning perfectly. Tight spreads, creation redemption working as it should. There have been no issues. And I know you just wrote a piece where you did a pretty deep dive on the topic of ETF trading. Can you maybe just briefly offer some perspective on what you saw last week? And I guess, do you agree? I mean, I didn't see any issues out there. Did anything, you know, show up on your radar?
No, I absolutely agree. I didn't see anything, and I didn't even read about anyone blaming ETFs for the decline either. Usually we have a couple articles pop up about people blaming ETFs, and I think that's probably the case because, you know, this time around there's an obvious culprit for the decline, the coronavirus. You can't really scapegoat ETFs this time around. But still, it's still yet another data point that kind of swats away the idea that ETFs are a ticking time bomb, especially, you know, things like junk bond ETFs, which people blame a lot. And, you know, I did write that piece for ETF.com, and I mentioned that ETFs are the most actively traded securities on any given day. They trade as many or more shares than the most actively traded stocks like Apple, Microsoft, Google, things like that. And that was the case last week also. Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas, I think, pointed out last week that SPY became the first stock or ETF to ever trade more than $100 billion worth of shares in a single day last week. And we saw HYG also had tremendous volume. That junk bond ETF traded over 100 million shares last Friday, the most it's ever traded in a single session. And yet the fund tracked its net asset value extremely closely. It was within 0.5% of its net asset value on either side, even though the prices for the fund were declining. And that's pretty much what we see in a typical week. So absolutely no problems on that front.
Well, I wrote about this yesterday. I think some people forget, or maybe they're just not aware, ETFs were actually created to provide a liquidity buffer. This after the 1987 stock market crash. And you look at how they traded in a week like last week, and that's exactly how they operated. They were a liquidity buffer. Investors turned to them. You know, they were a shock absorber with all the disruptive events in the market. So, you know, everything that I saw, they functioned perfectly. I just think it's another test that was passed. Sumeet, great stuff this week. I really appreciate the job you do tracking ETF flows and performance and trading. I know you do this every week, but I think when markets hit stretches like we saw, this can help add some context and perspective to everything going on. So thank you for taking the time this week. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks so much for having me.
That was ETF.com, Sumeet Roy. All right, my next guest is Connor Platt, founder of Confluence Analytics. They're an ESG-focused research firm who offers a whole suite of tools that allow investors to look at ESG ratings and how they impact the return characteristics of stocks and ETFs. Connor is joining me via phone from Pittsburgh. Connor, great having you back on the podcast. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Nate. Thanks for having me.
So last we connected, I'm sure you recall, we were actually spotlighting an ESG-focused ETF that you developed, the Etho Climate Leadership U.S. ETF, ticker Etho, E-T-H-O. I'm just curious, are you still involved with that ETF?
No, I was a co-founder and not involved in the day-to-day anymore, but happy to report that that ETF is alive and well, performing well. It was one of the first divestment-compliant ETFs that's actually outperformed the market since inception.
Okay, so then what led you down the path to founding Confluence Analytics?
So with Confluence Analytics, we wanted to make ESG a lot more actionable. We, you know, putting values to the side for a minute, all our work is about extracting what we think is the real value of ESG, which is risk mitigation, essentially keeping you out of trouble. So if you're looking at any sector and industry, and almost all ESG metrics are set up in a sector or industry or peer comparison as it should be. So just being able to avoid the bottom half of your sector through other risk metrics combined with a traditional approach can really make you a lot of money, or at least save you a lot of money.
Okay, so tell us more about Confluence Analytics, just in terms of exactly what you do, the services you provide.
Sure. So We do two things at the moment. We have on the marketplace, we've developed a series of ESG performance signals. Essentially, we developed that through a partnership we have with OwlShares. They are an aggregator of many different ESG data providers. We use that consensus view of the marketplace in ESG to build off and create forecasts, both stock level return forecasts and then ESG ratings forecasts. And that allows investors a better risk context to an ESG rating score. A common complaint is, you know, I have a high-ranked ESG stock. We can use Microsoft as an example. They're a perpetually high-ranked ESG stock. This doesn't really tell me what the risk is in Microsoft stock in terms of weighting it. And that's what I mean by actionable. We wanted signals that would at least give investors more risk context to the ESG exposures that they're taking on. And that is what the data analytics product is. We use those analytics to build investment solutions. We have three indices that are in process now. And the important aspect of our indices, and I know you guys talk about this a lot, Nate, is that they're active. So on a quarterly basis, we're able to rebalance portfolios using these signals and generate performance.
Okay, so Connor, I want to talk more about the ESG data itself. And a question that I have is, why is the data so different across the various ESG rating services? So I saw a chart last week from Credit Suisse where they showed ESG ratings from FTSE, Sustainalytics, and MSCI for six different large cap U.S. companies. That included Facebook, Walmart, Johnson & Johnson. And I've got to tell you, the ratings were all over the board for the various ESG categories. They also gave the example of Tesla, who listen to this, MSCI ranks Tesla at the top of the auto industry for sustainability. MSCI has them as the worst auto company. So why is that? Why isn't there more standardization here?
Well, I think a good analogy for all market participants is essentially consensus earnings. And so what exists at the stock level for earnings, the transparency of the high, low, and all the different analyst revisions to those numbers really doesn't exist currently in some economical way within the ESG industry, which is pretty much why we partnered with Owl, because the idea really is just start with the consensus view and then build on that. What goes on in the current ESG world that you're referring to is, yes, everybody has their own methodologies, good and bad. Makes a lot of sense why Tesla would be number one in sustainability within the auto industry and then at the bottom in governance. And how that sorts out in an overall rating is where you see a lot of the dispersion. So essentially, it's one of these cases where the ESG market is really just not that efficient for investors. I think as we talked about previously, Nate, you know, if you're a large asset manager and you're either entering the ESG world or looking to see how you can enhance it, the picture you're looking at is that you need to buy multiple providers. As good as any one provider might be, it won't be sufficient in terms of a view of the marketplace.
So if you look at some of the ESG ETFs on the market, to that point, I mean, do you think they do have significant shortcomings if they're relying on a single data provider for their ESG data?
I think a lot of ESG products have many significant problems. Increasingly, the way that it works is being overweight, high-ranked ESG stocks. And as our data sort of shows, that can work sometimes, but that's not very foolproof. You really need to be considering a lot of things. And what you see with a lot of these products is they're very overweight, big cap tech. And there's no disputing that big cap tech has a lot of very good sustainability features, but I don't know if that means you need to be, you know, overweight and overweight sector.
Something else I'm curious about the ESG data, how much of this is self-reported by companies versus independent third parties putting it together? So in other words, how good is the data integrity? Because isn't it possible for companies to misreport this data or maybe not even report it at all, which if they do that, as I understand it, then rating agencies just assume the worst. So how do you view that part of the equation?
Well, so it's been an evolution. Certainly 10, 15 years ago, all of this was self-reported. And then there was sort of the self-reporting curse where companies that where there were estimates and they actually gave the report, they were much worse than the estimates were supposed to be. But there's also been some real innovation, or at least some evolution here, which are third-party databases, similar to one group that stands out is Carbon Disclosure Project. And what they allow companies and the marketplace to do is a clearinghouse of carbon and environmental data such that on the company side, they can fill out and send their data to one place rather than filling out multiple forms and get it to the marketplace. And then on the marketplace side, you're getting a clearer view of what the carbon footprint and other environmental aspects of the marketplace are. And that's, and different versions of that type of crowdsourcing are happening and will continue to happen. Plus the companies are becoming more forthcoming, and but it's been an evolution. Essentially, I think it's no different than a lot of earnings data. I mean, people put way too much faith in things that get restated, so it's not too dissimilar with ESG. What's also happening, though, on the flip side is, and I think you've seen this, Nate, and people in the marketplace have seen this, there's new data providers trying to provide real-time metrics, whether they be in environmental, whether they be on legal and governance, certainly on sentiment. And those are spaces that I think ESG will shine and really help investors over time.
Connor, bigger picture, and you may have seen some of the stuff I've written about previously or talked about on this podcast, but something I've been struggling with on ESG, and you know, I'd love to just get your unabashed take on this. Aren't ESG risks and opportunities already priced into stocks? And I should say, look, I'm not some extreme efficient market hypothesis junkie, right? But at a basic level, aren't active managers paying attention to all this stuff? I mean, if an ESG data provider has identified a risk or opportunity, why wouldn't an active manager have done the same? And I guess my point is, I feel like ESG investing is really just investing. It's another data point or data set that goes into stock evaluation, like a company's earnings, which you were talking about earlier, or brand value or whatever. What am I getting wrong here with that line of thinking?
No, I think it's absolutely another tool. And in certain sectors and industries, it's more valuable than others. And then in terms of your point about the marketplace, I think we have a really good analogy out there right now where energy has become the new tobacco, if you will, a high yielding, plenty of sin and problems around it and a deserting client base. But as an institution, you'd be hard pressed to find any equity that's yielding, you know, north of 4% that you can get comfortable with. And energy will be one of those places that will be that next struggle. You can see many ESG investors, or certainly maybe not ESG investors, but pension and endowments that did not invest in tobacco.
But I guess my point is, I mean, well, do you think hedge fund managers and active mutual fund managers, are they incorporating ESG into their regular processes, ESG data, or are they currently ignoring it?
Oh, yes, they're including it, and they're including it in different ways. It may not be overtly ESG. So a data example would be a few years back, people were scraping Glassdoor to get a sense of company employee standing. And that's certainly an ESG approach. They may not have been thinking about it that way. I think that all investors, particularly quantitative investors, are looking at ESG to see if there are any signals that the market's ignoring. We think we found some of those. And it's partially because at least 50% of the market's ignoring ESG, I think, in one way or another. I think a lot of traditional investors have always had a strong emphasis on the G and in some cases, very, very deep experience in the G. And that drives a lot of the work that they do, whereas E and S have become a bit of a lesser focus.
So do you view ESG as something that potentially can provide outperformance or better risk-adjusted returns? Do you think it can actually make a difference and do good for society? Both, just high level, how do you view it?
I think that it can provide a much better, when integrated into other processes, I think it can, and it can add alpha. In terms of doing good, I think that if you're focusing capital on companies that are doing better than the average, you are doing good. And the scale that you get out of some of these companies, I mean, we're seeing some of the changes that companies are pledging. And if they meet or exceed those goals, it would be hard to say that that isn't a good thing. Microsoft going carbon negative in 2030, I don't see how that could be a bad thing. So if you're long those companies, and we can debate about the weights, but if you're invested and exposed to companies that we think ESG shows lower risk, a high ESG rank, or at least in our world, a high ESG rank coupled with a signal is a lower risk company, you focus your capital on those and away from higher risk companies, you should outperform and not have to work so hard.
What's your expectation for ESG investing moving forward? And if you want to just comment on, let's say, ESG ETFs only, that's fine. But what type of growth do you think we'll see here overall?
I mean, obviously, it's been quite a last year of a hockey stick in terms of ETF flows. So I think that, I don't know if that pace will quite continue, but it is a mega trend. How it folds into investing, I think increasingly it'll just be integrated into investing. And the places that are non-ESG will have risk characteristics that are appropriate. So sort of going back to my energy point, a yield that would allow investors to perhaps use some of it for carbon credits and still make a better than market rate return. So I think you've said it well, the marketplace adapts. If ESG is a mega trend, then it'll be incorporated in the market, and increasingly it is. It's certainly incorporated in all advertising and product development, so it's not hard to see why it's flowing right into the stock market.
Well, Connor, really appreciate the insight this week. I truly find this entire topic of ESG so fascinating. Quite frankly, I'm still trying to get my head around it all, but I'm keeping an open mind. So yeah. I really appreciate your perspective. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you, Nate. Take care.
That was Connor Platt, founder of Confluence Analytics. I'm now joined by Wes Gray, CEO of Alpha Architect, who currently offers 8 ETFs with close to $450 million invested, including a new ETF last year, the Freedom 100 Emerging Markets ETF, ticker symbol FRDM, Freedom, which is up for a bunch of ETF.com awards, by the way. Best new ETF of 2019, best new ESG ETF, the underlying index itself is up for Index of the Year, among other awards. But what's noteworthy is, this was the first ETF under Alpha Architect's white labeling service. They now have 3 ETFs here altogether. And this simply means if someone has a great ETF idea, they can bring it to Alpha Architect. And Alpha Architect has everything in place to take that ETF from idea to reality, bring that ETF to market. And again, this is in addition to Alpha Architect's own proprietary ETFs, which currently focus on value and momentum. Wes is on the line with me from just outside Philadelphia. Wes, always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, likewise, Nate. Honored to be here again, and I look forward to discussion.
Yeah, so we're going to bounce around on several different topics, but I do want to start with a white labeling business because there's really not a whole lot of good information out there on this, and I think investors might find it interesting hearing how some ETFs ultimately come to market. First, I'm just curious, what made you decide to get involved in the white labeling business?
Sure. Well, I mean, basically to solve the problem you just mentioned there. So Perth, who started this Freedom 100 Index, had approached us, and we just never thought about it, right? We'd always been internal, focused on doing our own stuff, but we'd already blown our brains out building all this technology and infrastructure. And when she approached us and said, hey, I want to work with you guys, I said, nah, we don't do that. And then she started explaining this industry, which is essentially a monopoly of like two or three players. And we're like, hey, we can compete in this business and probably do it cheaper, you know, more affordably and with more transparency. And we've already got the huge sunk cost of building all this infrastructure. Why not let entrepreneurs take advantage of that? So that's kind of how we ended up here, in a long story short.
Yeah, so explain some of the basics here. Like, how exactly do you help someone with a great ETF idea? How does that process work?
Sure. So one of the biggest kind of pain points that a lot of entrepreneurs have when they come to market with an ETF idea is dealing with all the compliance and regulatory components, right? So it's essentially like having an IPO for a company when you launch an ETF. So there's tons of brain damage involved in just the preparation, all the legal documents, all the filings with SEC. So we're going to help people get to market, which sounds easy, but like anything, it's actually harder than you think. And then once you've gotten to market and you essentially have your IPO for your fund, then we help people manage the day-to-day, like portfolio management, compliance, regulatory, all these sort of things.
Now, do you do anything on the marketing and distribution side, or does the person behind the ETF handle all of that?
Yes. So in our offering, we don't do that. We're of the belief that in this marketplace, in this day and age, it's got to be a passion project. So whoever's idea it is should be the salesperson, because they're going to be the person that has the most passion for it, where I may like the idea, but the reality is I'm probably not the right person to sell it. And so we encourage people, like, listen, if you're willing to be the person that can sell this, thought lead this, you know, convince people this is a reasonable idea, we will deliver a very efficient, lean, high-quality, you know, back-office servicing operation, essentially. But you, the salesperson or idea person, is going to have to, you have to be the passion behind the project.
Does the ETF rule change anything here in terms of the white labeling business? Just that it's now easier to bring new products to market. Does that matter at all to somebody who has an ETF idea?
I think you talked about a lot on Twitter, and I think you got it right. But a lot of people are like, oh, you know, in the mainstream media just have no clue. They're like, oh, this is going to make the cost of entrepreneurship and the barriers to entry to launch an ETF come way down. And they're really talking about the fact that you don't need to get, like, the exemptive relief. But that's, like, 10 grand. And the reality is that's nothing in the grand scheme of launching an ETF, where all the tough part is, you know, the operations, the compliance, the trading, the, you know, the selling, the distribution. Like, that's where the barriers to entry are. It's not the, you know, saving 10 grand on the exemptive relief. That almost doesn't even matter. So it's definitely nice at the margin. But in the end, as you know, in our business, like ETF and asset management business in general is just insanely competitive, and, you know, it's just difficult. And no amount of regulatory actions is going to, unfortunately, minimize that anytime soon.
Okay, so I think that raises an interesting question. If somebody does have a unique ETF idea, what do you think that overall decision-making process should be as to whether they decide to launch it on their own or use somebody like you? I mean, does it come down to cost or capability to handle the back office? I mean, what do you think are the key decision-making points there?
There's trade-offs in everything. And I take the philosophy of crawl, walk, run, which is old, military concept to kind of de-risk everything. You don't want to just start hitting the ground running. And so theoretically, if someone's like, hey, I want to set up an ETF business, they could build all the infrastructure pipes that we've already built and burn, you know, millions of dollars on fire. And that might be an appropriate path if they have the capital and they're willing to do that. But for most people, we recommend the crawl, walk, run philosophy, where it's like, hey, down the road, maybe you want to do that, but let's start small and just try to launch one successful idea. And the win-win is you can leverage our infrastructure, because we can get you to market for, let's say the all-in is like 250 grand, right? Like, that's a lot better than 1 to 2 million, and you don't have to do much. So it's just a trade-off. Like, you can either outsource it, get the market fast, efficiently, or you can try to build out the whole business, and obviously you're going to have more control, but you're also going to have a lot more cost. And I think it just depends on the situation and what you're trying to achieve, basically.
What about your decision-making process for whether an ETF is a good fit? And, you know, I think about yourself and Alpha Architect as a whole. A lot of people know who you are. You're out there. And obviously, you're not just going to take anybody that shows up and knocks on your door with an ETF idea. So what are you looking for?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like anything. Like, the number one thing, obviously, is honor and integrity. So people that, you know, I can bring them to my house, we can host them, and, you know, I feel like they're, you know, good tribal members, so people we can trust, basically. So once you check that box, okay, great, let's move on. The next thing we look for, it's pretty straightforward. Basically, prove to us that you can pay your bills for at least 2 to 3 years, and prove to us that you can bring at least $5 million in investment capital day one. And that seems like a high barrier, but in the end, it's not going to be a win-win if we launch the ETF and you can't pay the bills, which means we're going to lose, and you can't put any assets in it, because that means we're wasting everyone's time.
Right.
So, but yeah, so as long as you got good honor, integrity, we trust you, and then you could pay your bills, and you could bring some capital to the problem, where maybe you got like a 2-3 year runway, we're willing to, you know, jump in the pool with you and you know, give it a whirl. Now, nothing's a guarantee, but at least you got a chance of potential success.
I know how well you understand the financial markets, and my view of you is that you have really strong conviction around your investment beliefs. Do you have to believe in a product from an investment standpoint, or are you more concerned about product viability? And to your point, some of the intangibles, the trust factor, and the fact that the person with the idea is fully committed.
Yeah, so we are not here on this in that business. It's basically like the equivalent of like the shovel selling business. We will not necessarily say, hey, I'm going to jump up and down for this particular product. I'm going to put all my personal capital in it like we do with our own products. And that's not to say that it's good or bad. It's just that we understand that there's different segments, different needs, and different utility functions out there. And, hey, if you want to bring a good product to market that someone will enjoy and pay for, and it's a, you know, good functioning idea, we will help you, the entrepreneur, make that happen. And that's why I said at the beginning, we don't help sell these things, but we will make sure that you don't go to jail and the thing operates efficiently. It's on you, the entrepreneur, to, you know, convince people this was a good idea. So we don't stand behind them from an investment perspective per se, as much as we would obviously on our own products where, you know, we put our money into the things personally. And we generally like the strategies, but the level of conviction is different, obviously, for white labeling versus our own stuff in general.
And by the way, I should have mentioned that in addition to Freedom, which again is up for a bunch of ETF.com awards, the other two ETFs are the Merlin AI Bull Rider Bear Fighter ETF, ticker WIZ, W-I-Z, and the Merlin AI Tactical Growth and Income ETF, ticker SNUG, S-N-U-G. I find the white labeling business fascinating. Wes, I do want to switch gears and talk a little bit about ESG. So this is a topic we covered earlier in the show. And I saw the tweet you had last week that I guess I interpreted is poking some fun at ESG. So you asked whether ESG is the new quote-unquote science of investing, right? And you pointed out how 2 years ago the hot topic or best science involved machine learning. 4 years ago it was factor investing. Do you feel like ESG is just the flavor of the month?
So in general, what I would say is yes. Like any time the product people are out there banging the wall and trying to sell you something, you just always want to be skeptical, especially if this flavor tends to change every few years. So that's not to say that there's not like some kernel of truth that, you know, ESG and these sort of concepts is something you should, you know, shake your head at or whatever. It's just that from the product standpoint, you want to be very skeptical that, you know, maybe this quote-unquote ESG fund you're buying, wait a second, is that really just the S&P 500 that I pay 10 times as much for? And I think what happens is when people look under the hood and try to understand what they're actually buying, a lot of times, not just ESG, but other things as well, they're in the end, they're just buying marketing pitch. They're not buying substance. And so that's kind of the context behind that tweet. And it certainly feels like ESG is leaning more towards the marketing component versus the value add component, at least how I currently see it. You know, obviously other people can agree to disagree. That's just my opinion on it as it currently stands.
Okay, so to be fair, I do have to ask you, the Freedom 100 Emerging Markets ETF Freedom, that is up for best new ESG ETF. So, you know, what's different here?
Well, so nothing's different. It's just, and like I said, I have nothing against ESG. And I just happen to really personally like the ESG of Freedom. I was a Marine Corps officer. Like, I love America. You know, I'm one of these maniacs that hangs a flag out every day. So for me personally, I love Freedom. I love promoting anything that stands for that. And so, yeah, this is ESG. I don't force anyone to buy this. I don't sell it. But I think it's a cool idea. And I like Perth, and I want to support her cause. So I stand behind that. Now, is it the same sort of stance I would take where I said, hey, it's like value investing where there's, you know, 200 years of data and there's been 1,000 professors that have identified that, yes, this works over the long haul. No, it's a total different, lens of viewing. And that's fine. There's, you know, something for everyone in the marketplace. And, you know, to the extent that I personally would want to do ESG, this is the kind of ESG that I would want to do. But that doesn't mean it's for everyone. And like I said, we are not pitching this as, like, something that's going to, like, you know, destroy the world with great performance and, you know, be the next panacea. We're just saying, hey, this is an offering and an opportunity that if you believe in freedom and want to convey that view via an investment, this is an option.
Wes, going back to your point on sort of the efficacy of ESG factors and perhaps their ability to outperform, you know, again, obviously you're a strong believer in value and momentum. And as you mentioned, those two factors have withstood tremendous academic rigor over a long, long period of time. Do you think ESG can ever get to that point? Or do you view it as completely different than those other factors and other proven factors that are in the marketplace?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it could. I mean, the issue on all this stuff is you need a lot of data, a lot of time to kind of flesh these things out. And then the other thing you understand is usually in the marketplace, you get paid for pain. So if it's easy for people to say, oh, I would love to own Exxon because, you know, it feels good to have, you know, own an energy producer, but that's not the case. Like, I think it's a lot easier for people from, like, a behavioral standpoint. It's very easy to own ESG. And anytime something is easy in the financial marketplace, you should expect, on average, to earn marginally lower returns. And there's nothing wrong with that. So that's my opinion on ESG is, people that pitch it as a way to earn extra return, that's probably not true to the extent that everyone wants to buy ESG and it feels good and it's easy to do. Because you, like I said, easy things to do usually don't get paid extra on the long-term scale of investing. So it's just a trade-off.
That's an excellent point, and actually one I haven't heard before. And I would add to that it's been even easier to own ESG in a 10-year bull market. Right.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And that's the other thing. And that's kind of at the top there. Like, when you really do a look through on ESG funds, what are they? They're basically tech funds. They all, you know, whether that's actually ESG or not, but they're basically funds that own mega cap tech. Well, guess what did really well the last 10 years? Mega cap tech.
Exactly.
You know, if it was underperforming by whatever, like value, like you don't see a lot of, you know, value out there these days. Like, you know, I doubt ESG would be as popular right now. But we'll see. If it starts underperforming and people, you know, still want to throw money at it, then, you know, maybe I'm wrong. But my guess is there'll be a new flavor of the day. And I don't know what that is yet, but that's the cycle of the investment business.
Yeah, there's always a new flavor of the day.
Yeah. Anything that they could do to earn more than, like, what Vanguard's charging, someone's going to sell it out there, right? So it's just, and 99% of the time what people are selling is just a bunch of bunk. So you've got to be very careful about, you know, if I'm going to do extra spend, let's make sure I'm actually getting some value for this and not, you know, some great marketing pitch or whatever. So,
Wes, a couple of minutes left before I let you go. You mentioned doing a look through on ESG funds. On a related note, I wanted to ask you about your ETF portfolio construction tools that you offer at alphaarchitect.com. Sure. So investors can look through their portfolios. They can see factor tilt, active share, right? Those types of things. The question I have for you is you see all sorts of ETF portfolios, especially from advisors. What are some of the common mistakes or issues you see? And maybe mistake is too strong of a word, but what are some things that you find lurking in portfolios that advisors might not have noticed?
So the number one thing we see, and we usually generally deal with advisors who are fiduciaries and generally interested in their clients' benefits. So what I'm about to mention, to your point, it's not like anything against them. It's just sometimes if you don't have the tools and the capabilities, it's hard to even know if you're screwing something up, even if you're trying your best. And so typically what will happen when we see portfolios proposed by advisors and ask us for 2 cents on it is when you actually I'll give a hypothetical example that's not true, but just to make the point. So you go get the portfolio. It has S&P 500, has Russell 1000, Russell 1000 value, Russell 1000 growth. And then it'll have small cap value, small cap growth. And what happens is when you actually look through all these funds and the associated weights with the underlying holdings, and you pretend like, hey, let's just get rid of all the ETF wrappers and remap that portfolio, what ends up happening 9 times out of 10 is you go to the advisor and you're like, hey, man, just so you know, you just replicated the Russell 1000 but with way more expenses. You could have just bought one ticker as opposed to 10. So that's typically the genre of the problem we usually see is people are buying a bunch of different tickers, not realizing that they're just essentially replicating the Vanguard fund again, which, is probably not what they're meaning to do, I guess.
But to your point, I mean, does that come down to a lack of access to proper tools? I mean, is that ultimately what you find is the issue?
I think it is because a lot of times there's maybe some weird incentive for the advisor to do that because they want to look like they're doing something. So that's a pretty rare circumstance. I think most of the time they just don't understand that because, to your point, they don't have the technology and capability to do that. And that's fine. That's why we've been building these tools, because this is what we do. We sit around and program and, geek out on data. And then, we get input from advisors who have a problem. And then we look at our job, hey, we got to help fix this problem, help people, make better decisions. So we're trying to lead the front here to try to help people make better decisions and be more informed. But just like anything, education is a slow go in this world.
Well, and I guess not to set you up for a shameless plug, but can anybody access those tools at alphaarchitect.com or how will that work as you build out those different?
So right now, just because of compliance and all kinds of other issues, it's like the tools are available to like our clients and kind of close holds and people who will sign off that they're a financial professional. Down the road, we definitely have plans to kind of open that up, but as you know, like we're in like the most regulated business on the planet Earth, so we have to, even though we're trying to help out the end consumer, we just got to make sure we do this in like a nice regulatory compliant way, so we don't go to jail, indirectly through trying to help people, which is crazy, but that's just kind of the nature of our how the world works in our business. So we will try to get this out to as many people as possible in a compliant way that is, friendly to regulators and all these other things, for sure.
Well, Wes, always enjoy our conversations. I really love everything you and your team are building at Alpha Architect. Congratulations on all the success so far, and I certainly look forward to chatting again soon. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, sir, and same to you with the radio and podcast stuff you guys are putting out. It's awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That was Wes Gray, CEO of Alpha Architect. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. If you enjoyed the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, the topic is thematic ETFs. We're going to cover these in depth, and I have two fantastic guests for you. Leighton Sparr, president of Alps Advisors, and John Mayer, chief investment officer at GlobalX ETFs. We're going to talk about where thematic ETFs fit in a portfolio, how best to evaluate thematic ETFs, and we'll certainly look at several thematic ETFs from both providers. Until then, have a great week, everyone.